Oh dear, I am a littler person. I shop in the petites department, so I'm gonna bring the microphone down. But I think you all can see me, right? I don't need the step stool. I was thinking about the step stool, but I'm not gonna use it. Okay, so good morning, everybody. I'm Heather. I'm an alcoholic. Hello. I am very happy to be here. I'm a little nervous, but That's good. I actually enjoy speaking. I have anxiety, and of course, public speaking is one of the biggest fears if you have anxiety, but I do get a little helper's high when I share. So thanks for helping me feel good this morning and getting to share and getting to be here. When Dana asked me to speak, I was like, man, where in Ridgecrest? Home of Dana Banana? Dana's my sober sister. Dana's the one that invited me up here. We share a sponsor. Her name is Pat, and Pat sponsors Nona, and Nona's from California City. She's sitting next to Dana Banana over there, so thank you, Nona, for coming out. Nona took my sponsor Pat through the steps. Pat took me and Dana Banana through the steps, so that's how it works. So thank you both for being here, and thanks, everybody, for having me out here. Yeah, I drove 3 hours to get here, and it's funny, I was thinking about it. You know, I always like to hear excuses from especially the new people when they can't make it to a meeting, right? You know, oh, I don't have a car, or oh, you know, I had this other thing I had to do. You know, I always say to people, well, you know, when you were drinking and using drugs, you know, did you have a car then? Did you still make it then? You know, and I drove 3 hours to get here. If you would have told me they were serving free booze out in the desert, and it was 3 hours away, and it was going to be all weekend long, I would have signed up, and I would have been here an hour before the event started, and I'd stay here till an hour after the event was done, especially if there was an open bar. So I'm happy to be out here. I go with my sobriety with that same level of excitement and determination. So I was determined to come out here from West LA. I live in West LA. I go to meetings in Culver City. My home group is the Studio Group. It's one of the longest continuous running meetings in all of Los Angeles. We've been meeting since December of 1940. Long, long time ago. Shortly after the big book was written and this program was formed. So I love my home group. I heard if you don't love your home group, find a new home group. And I can honestly say I love my home group. My sobriety date is August 27th, 2012. So I'm a little over 10 and a half years sober. And I got sober at 33 years old. I'm now 44. And I spent 16 years drinking as a periodic social blackout drinker. I was not the kind of drink at home and get depressed kind of drinker. I'm actually a little jealous of those folks that only stayed home and didn't go out and tear up the town, because I was a tear up the town kind of girl. A little bit about my family, since I do have enough time in this year to talk about it. I don't always talk about my family, but I'll give you a little bit of background. My family, I identify as growing up in a dysfunctional family. Which a lot of people do. I've actually worked the steps in another program for that called Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunctional Families. And I through that program and through working the steps there and working the steps here and doing my amends with my parents are still living. They're still insane. They're still dysfunctional. But through the work of the steps, I've been able to forgive them and for everything that happened in that childhood and the dysfunctional family that we had with emotional abuse, physical abuse. My dad financially abused our family. My mom lost all their money. I call it a rageaholic. He's also, you know, he loves to rage. He gets really high off of, you know, hurting people, hurting things, throwing things. He likes to gamble in the stock market. Legalized gambling, right? He's lost all my parents' money a couple times in the stock market. My mom is not an alcoholic. She's a pill addict. She's a pill popper. I can remember her, you know, getting into car accidents when we were younger, and you know, I can remember her always having a headache, always laying around in bed. And I learned a lot about that when I went to that dysfunctional family group, because I didn't even really know that that was an addiction. I just knew my mom was always tired, and I knew that she was always, you know, always had a headache, and she always had to lay in bed. And I did ask my parents when I got sober, because I heard, you know, this is a family disease. And I didn't understand it. I felt different because I was like, it's not in my family. My dad's this rager. My mom's this pill popper. And then I asked my parents, hey, do we have any alcoholism in our family? My mom goes, are you kidding me? Your grandparents drink every day. I was like, oh, I was so little, I didn't notice. So I guess my parents were alcoholics, I assume, if you drink every day. But I am the first person in my family to enter recovery. I do have a brother who is also an alcoholic. He's been in and out of AA. He's had multiple DUIs. He's a surgeon, and he has a criminal record, and you can see his, you know, his mugshots online if you Google him, the doctor, and but he still practices, and it's pretty scary. But he does. He's very good at what he does. Alcoholics are very good at what we do. We're very smart people. We're very determined people. Everybody in my family is really successful. I grew up, anxiety and depression. I identify with that, you know, and I understand in the book, it talks about a lot of us drink over anxiety, depression, excitement, and I identify with that. And when I was little, I expressed it in being like a class clown and being a party girl and kind of always being very social. I used a lot of sense of humor because what was going on at home was really sad and depressing and had a lot of anxiety over it. So I'd go to school and I'd kind of act out and be really funny and make everybody laugh, and I was the class clown. And my first addiction was sugar. I never drank at home when I was before college because I was really afraid of what if my dad ever found me drunk. I knew I would be killed. So I never drank until I got to college, and I had my first drunk, an alcoholic drunk, very classic. I was in the dorm rooms. I had never drank before, and I thought maybe my mom was maybe addicted to pills. I wasn't really sure. I did have a roommate who, like, when I pulled out 800 milligram Motrins that I'd gotten from my mom, she was like, whoa, what are you doing with pills that big? I was like, oh, these are just my mom's. This is what she takes every day, you know, this and the OxyContin and stuff. She's like, oh, Heather, that's not normal. You know, moms aren't supposed to always take all that kind of stuff. So, oh, maybe my mom has a pill addiction. I don't know. So I thought, you know, I don't want to. The one good thing about my mom being a pill addict, it made me, I have a healthy fear of doing drugs. And I have a healthy fear of getting addicted to pills. And so I've never done, not yet, YET, you're eligible too, not yet, have I ever done or been addicted to drugs. That's one of the weird things about my story. I've never even smoked weed. Everybody says, but weed, you've smoked weed, right? No, I've never even smoked weed. So I do think that was one benefit of seeing what my mom was going through. I never touched a drug. Every time I was offered drugs, I was like, oh, no, I will like that. I have a feeling I will like that. Cocaine, no way. I will do so much, I will die. I just know, because I'm very black or white. You're going to give it to me, I'm going to do all the lines. I'm not going to do one line, I'm going to do all the lines. So let's not even go there. So I passed up all the drugs, but I drank. And I started off with Blue Label Popov, which 100 proof. I figured that'll get the job done the quickest, and I'm going to drink this, and I'm going to hate it, and I'm never going to want to drink again. So we sat there in the dorms, my boyfriend and I at the time, and we just took shots of Blue Label Popov. I took 7 shots my first time ever drinking. I drank alcoholically literally from the first drink. And I vomited all night long. It was absolutely horrible. I probably had alcohol poisoning. We didn't go to the ER or anything, but yeah, I was like, man, I probably shouldn't do that again. But I'm in college and we're supposed to party, right? So that ended up breaking up with that boyfriend. And 2 triggers for me that I've figured out with my story and my alcoholism: breakups are a major trigger for my drinking, and health problems. And that guy ended up breaking up with me, and I just went to town. I mean, that's when Heather the party girl, that's where she was formed. I became known at my college. I'm from Michigan. I went to Western Michigan University, and I became the party girl. And I was going all over town. It was mostly, it started, it's a progressive disease. So I started just drinking on the weekends at the parties, and I actually met my ex-husband now in a blackout. I was in a blackout. Like I said, I'm a social blackout drinker, so I went to a lot of parties. I was in a blackout and met this guy, gave him my phone number to our dorm room, and the next day I had no memory of it. And I actually said to my roommate, you know, hey, I think I danced with some guy last night. She's like, yeah, you gave him your number. I was like, oh, I did? And she's like, yeah. And then he calls and says, hey, Heather, will you come over? Well, I don't even remember what the guy looks like. You know, I literally met the guy in a blackout. And she had to go with me when I went over to his house for the first time. And I said, just nudge me when the dude walks in the door. And because he had four roommates, and I didn't even know which of the five he was. So went over there, of course, to go hang out with the roommates and drink. And yeah, he walked down and there he was. She nudged me and that was it. We dated for a few years and then got married. And I was in an alcoholic marriage for 13 years. There's a book back there from Al-Anon, The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage. When I was new, I read that book and boy, does that describe my marriage. I had met my match, basically. I'd met my party buddy, my match. And, you know, when you're drinking with alcoholism, it's a little bit easier to keep drinking with alcoholism when you also married an alcoholic. And so the both of us were blackout drinkers. We were both partiers. He was perfect for me and for my disease, actually. And, you know, my topic is surrender. We just surrendered to a party life. We surrendered to the fact that we didn't even want to have kids because who has time for kids when you're drinking? And who wants to spend their money on children? So we agreed when we first got married that kids were out of the picture. You know, people always ask me, how come you never had kids? Why didn't I have kids? Because I didn't want to spend the time and the money on them. Because that's how selfish and self-centered I was with my drinking. I was a party girl, and I knew well enough if I had kids, I wasn't going to take care of them. I was going to be out drinking. And I didn't want them to get in the way of my drinking. So I made it through. I was a good student, a really good student. I made it through school, had a scholarship, got through graduate school. I was the president of my grad school class. And we moved out here to LA for better weather. Better weather, more opportunities. He wanted to become an entertainment lawyer. He went to law school. So we move out here, and all it did was just pour more fuel on the fire of our alcoholism. We had a bigger city. We were bar drinkers, so we had a lot more bars to go to, a lot more people to party with, and we started getting a little bit of money. I got a job, and we moved out here after grad school. And as the saying goes, we got more money and more problems. And the disease, it just got bigger and bigger. And we started out really fun. You know, I got sober and we had Blackberries. And I used to keep in my Blackberry a list of bars I want to try. And that was literally how we controlled, like how we hung out. And we'd plan our vacations based upon where are the bars and which hotels are closest to the bars. We went to Las Vegas a lot. Why? Because there's free booze in Vegas, and we drink a lot, and it gets really expensive. So we started out, and Nona likes to use this analogy, and I think it's a really good one. We started out really, really big with our drinking. A lot of fun, you know, going all over town. We're going to all these parties. We're in LA now, and but eventually, it's like an hourglass shape. Your drinking gets smaller and smaller, and your life gets smaller and darker and deeper into your disease that you get. And then eventually, once you get sober, the hourglass kind of starts to open up again, and things start to open up again and fill up again. And so that is exactly what happened with our drinking and with my drinking. We went from going all over town, but eventually, because I'm a blackout drinker, I'm getting kicked out of places. I'm getting carried out of places. You know, I'm passing out everywhere. I'm blackout drunk. So eventually, you know, and I had things happen to me, you know, and none of my consequences got me sober. I broke bones. curbed myself one night and, you know, messed up my jawbone. Fights were always breaking out when we'd go out, and none of that got me sober. At the end, like I said, it got really dark and really narrow and really small. And we had surrendered so much to alcohol in this party life that all we did, we found our last apartment. I got really into karaoke at the end of my drinking. And we picked our apartment in West LA near Sepulveda and National because it was within walking distance of three karaoke bars. Three dive bars. And I realized later when I looked at things, you know, the reason I did that is because dive bars, they won't kick you out. You know, these are seedy little dark places. And they were like little Cheers bars. Everybody knew us at these places. We were known. So we didn't have to drive. We were responsible drinkers. We didn't have to drive. So we literally, I was like the drunken mayor of West LA dive bars at the end. And just, I had a little bicycle, we'd ride our bike, I'd go down to Culver City to the Tattletale Lounge. There was this Gabe's on Sepulveda and Lost and Found over on National. And those were our three places. And every single Friday, Saturday, and then they had free pool on Sunday. We were there every single weekend. And then there was karaoke night on Wednesday. Gabe's opened up. So then I had to go on Wednesday too, and it got a little more progressive. We got to go a little bit more. And by the end, my health was falling apart. My skin was gray. I remember looking in the mirror one day, just looking, going, who are you? You know, what happened to you? You used to be pretty. You used to have blue eyes. Now you have gray eyes, you have gray skin, you look really old. You know, I was in my 30s and I looked like I was in my 40s. And one of the things I had done while I was blackout drunk on an airplane, I love to, that's another one of my triggers is traveling. I love to get wasted and go on airplanes and travel. And I got wasted on an airplane and got blood clots on an airplane because I was passed out drunk going back and forth to New York. So they put me on blood thinners, and you know, you're not supposed to drink on blood thinners. And they tell you, you know, you got to cut back your drinking if you're going to be on these blood thinners. Well, if you're an alcoholic, what does that mean? Okay, I'll cut back, but I went all the way back to what I did in the very beginning of my disease. I'll just go back to 100 proof vodka. Duh, you know, if I can't drink as much, I will just drink less drinks and I'll make it count. I gotta increase the proof. So I went back all the way at the very end of my drinking. The last like 2 years, all I drank was 100 proof vodka again. And I had a vodka bottle at the karaoke bar. They knew me, they had my bottle, and that was it at the end. And my stomach was in so much pain. I had horrible stomach pain. I was really overweight, and it was like Groundhog Day. I just went to work every weekend. I was so obsessed with it, and I was so, I had excluded my friends. I had stopped answering calls from my parents, and my parents called me. I'd sometimes answer the call like a month later. They didn't know if I was dead or alive. I was so selfish and self-centered and just surrendered to this party girl life. That was who I was. And if you want to find me, there was actually friends who one night I was at Gabe's on Sepulveda, and my friends showed up there unannounced. I was like, oh my gosh, you guys come here too? They're like, no, we want to hang out with you. And we know if we want to hang out with you, this is where we got to go. This is where we got to find you. You know, it was really sad. And I was just like, wow, I'm that predictable, huh? And they're like, yeah, we know you're here every single weekend. So I was totally haggard. But the thing that was tricky about this was I still looked okay on the outside in terms of I still had my job. I still had my car. You know, I was kind of still hanging on things on the outside, but the outsides did not match my insides. My insides, I was dying on the inside. I was depressed. I was very anxious. And when you pour alcohol, a depressant, on depression, it just gets worse. And it got really, like I said, really dark, really narrow. I didn't leave that one little mile radius, and it was no more fun. It went from fun to fun with problems to just problems. Health problems, marriage problems, emotional problems. And but none of that got me sober. The thing that actually got me to surrender and to come into the program, I found a text message on his phone that said that he might be cheating on me. That's what struck me sober. That's what struck me into knowing we needed to get help, I should say. That didn't strike me sober. That struck me into knowing we needed to get help. And in fact, he needed to get help, right? I also identify with Al-Anon. I came in here through the back doors of Al-Anon. So as soon as I saw that, I said, oh my God, you might be cheating on me. This is the end of our partying. We have been partying way too much. This is all we're doing. We need to stop, and you really need to stop. And I heard if you got one finger pointing out, you got three fingers pointing back. You know, I was telling him he needed to stop, but in reality, we both needed to stop, and I needed to stop just as bad. And so I was complaining to my coworker, and she ended up becoming my Eskimo, the person who brought me in from the cold, from out there of drinking. I was complaining to my coworker about this marriage that was falling apart and how he was lying and he was cheating and he was drinking too much. And she said, oh, you might find help at this program called Al-Anon. And I said, I have never heard of that. I'm not an alcoholic. Why would I go to Al-Anon? And she said, no, Heather. My son's an alcoholic. I go to this program because it's for friends and family members of alcoholics. And you might find some help there. And so she connected me to the website. We found a meeting. And I did. I went to that meeting. And that was my first introduction to recovery and to the 12 steps. And I literally became obsessed with getting him sober. And I went to those meetings. I listened to the stories. And those sneaky Al-Anon ladies, you know, they always tell you, why don't you go check out an AA meeting? You know? Why don't you just check it out? Get sympathy for the alcoholic. You know, and I was so angry at him. I had so much anger and resentment, anxiety and depression when I came in here. But I listened, I surrendered. That was my first surrender, my first positive surrender, was surrendering to the advice of what those people told me to do. And so I did what they told me to do. And I went to, I looked up in the directory, what's a good meeting to find him a sponsor? And to find him this big book they're talking about. So that's how I found the studio group in Culver City. The Tuesday night meeting is the beginner's meeting. So I thought, well, that's the perfect spot to get him a sponsor and, you know, get him started on this step work. So I went to that meeting in Culver City. Everybody's welcome, by the way. It's on Zoom. We're hybrid. So if you just Google Studio Group AA, you can come check us out. We're there on Tuesdays and Fridays. And that Tuesday meeting was my first ever AA meeting. And I walked in, and it's a topic meeting. And the topic that night, it's a topic, and then the second half we do question and answer. Newcomers can put anonymous questions in the basket, and we answer them after the break. It's a cool, cool meeting, my favorite meeting. And the topic that night was, what are your favorite things about sobriety? And so I started hearing from these people. And my sponsor, Pat, shared that, and I'll never forget her share. She said, my marriage was able to come back together. She said, I was ready to file for divorce when I came in here, and I got sober, and I realized a lot of my problems in my marriage were me. And there were this guy talked about reconnecting with his family and reconnecting with his daughter. His daughter didn't want anything to do with him, and he got sober, and he was able to have a relationship with his daughter. And I realized I hadn't been talking to my parents. Like I said, I wasn't returning calls. You know, I'd go to visit my sister in Michigan, and she had little boys. I would walk right past the little boys, and I would literally say to them, when you turn 21, Aunt Heather's going to hang out with you, because then you can come to the bar with me, and I'll show you fun. You know, I hadn't been an aunt. You know, I hadn't been connected to my family. My marriage was falling apart. And then people also talked about feeling better. The anxiety got better. The depression was lifted. People talked about no more stomach pain and how I look so much better. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is all the things that I want. These are all the things that I'm looking for. And At the end of the meeting, Pat, my now sponsor, came up to me and she said, "Hey, you know, I notice you're new." And she's like the newcomer greeter, and she gives these newcomer packets out. And I said, "Well, yeah, I am new, but, you know, I'm in this alcoholic marriage. You know, I'm married to this alcoholic." And, "Oh, okay, you're here for him. Yeah, do you have any sponsors here? Are there any guys that sponsor here? Jill, yeah, that guy Paul over there, he sponsors." So she said, "But why don't you not leave without any literature?" And so I think it's so important that you let the newcomers, you know, welcome them in, get literature in their hands. Whether they read it or not that day or another day, I went home and she gave me two things. She gave me the AA 20 questions, and she gave me some newcomer pamphlets, and she gave me a big book. And I said, "Perfect, I'm going to go home and take that quiz for him." And she said, "Well, I'll give you two copies." I said, "All right, I'll take his first, and then I'll take mine." So I did. I went home, and I took the AA 20 questions, and that's when I realized I was an alcoholic. I took that quiz and went, "Oh, my God, these things aren't normal." I had no idea. You know, I just knew I was having fun. You know, or so I thought I did, you know, or so I thought I was. So that was my first big surrender. I had surrendered to the fact that I am an alcoholic, and my life was unmanageable. And I cried. And I cried at that first meeting. And someone actually said to me, usually the one, it's good if you cry at your first meeting, because it's usually the ones who cry who actually stay. And I did. I cried through that whole meeting. And I went home, and I started reading the big book with my husband. And he was like, nope, not going to do it. And I was like, "All right, you do you. I've been going to Al-Anon." And he's like, "You've been going to what?" So I admitted to him, "You know, I'm going to Al-Anon. And these people say, you know, you just got to take care of yourself. And you know what? I think I'm going to take care of myself." And I learned the Serenity Prayer. I heard him saying the Serenity Prayer: accept the things you can't change. Change the things you can. And I realized I can't change him. I can't force him to get sober. I can't force him to stop cheating. He was also losing my money. He was also, I realized, 2 months into my sobriety, I figured out he had not just been an alcoholic and cheating. He was a gambling addict. And the money was gone. It took me 2 months of sobriety to realize that. And I realized I had to stay for me. I got to AA because of him and wanting to get him sober, but the important thing was I stayed for me. And that's really important, because marriages end. You know, if you come in here just for someone else in another relationship, sometimes those relationships end. And then, well, then that gives you an excuse to leave, right? But I came in for him, and I ended up staying for me. So I went back to that group, and I kept going. I went for a couple months. I wasn't sure, do I want to do this? Do I not want to do this? Maybe I should just file for divorce. Forget it. You know, and I don't need to do all this AA stuff. And I heard two things at this beginner's meeting. A lot of good advice. These people, there's people in our group that have 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years of sobriety. You know, stick with the winners. And when you got decades of sobriety, those are some winners. And I heard them say a couple things. I kept putting in, you know, it's a question and answer format. I was putting in the basket, why should I do the 12 steps? You know, I'm really stubborn, and I, you know, I want to do the shorter way. Do I really have to do the steps? Do I really have to get a sponsor? You know, what if I'm not sure? You know, I took that 20 questions, but what if I'm still not sure if I want to be a sober alcoholic? So finally, there were two things I heard them say. One was, but I did like the meetings. I will say I liked the meetings. One of the things I actually said to my ex-husband when I got home from that first meeting, I said, this is where all, I'm from Michigan, right? And Michigan people are super nice. And I said, this is where all the people, the nice people are in Los Angeles. They're in these AA meetings. You can't believe how nice these people are in this program. And so I stuck around, and I stuck around because I was starting to feel a little bit better. And I heard someone say, meetings will help you feel better, but it's the steps. The steps are where you get better. So just by going for the first few months and still drinking a little bit, trying to control drinking, that was when I first realized I could not control and enjoy my drinking. I was able to control it and have one drink. We went on one more vacation. And I drank one drink, and I set it down. And I was like, I'm not going to drink the other half. I'm not going to drink the other half. Oh my God, I want to drink the other half. I want to drink the other half. Why do other people not drink the other half? Like, why would you not drink a full drink? You know, I was obsessed with it. I could not control it and enjoy it. I did not enjoy that meal at all because I was obsessed over that drink. Two things that I heard. One, it's a form of insanity to be in a 12-step program and not working the 12 steps. It's a form of insanity to be in the program, a 12-step program, and not work the 12 steps. Oh, so you're calling me insane, huh? Okay. And then the other thing I heard when I kept putting in the basket, you know, I don't know if I want to do the steps. I don't know if I want to stay sober. This guy, Anthony, at the meeting, he's an old-timer. Anthony said, you know, someone keeps asking these questions, and there's somebody obviously who's here who's not sure if they want to be here. And I just have to say this to you. I'm going to challenge you. If you can stay sober, why don't you just try this? Try this. Mm-hmm. Try the steps. Get a sponsor. I don't know if you have a sponsor yet, but get a sponsor. Take some commitments. Do the 12 steps. And if you can stay sober for 1 year, and at the end of that year, you've decided it's still not worth it, and you're still miserable, and you don't want to stay sober anymore, you come up and you come find me. I'm going to buy you your first drink. And I don't know why, but that hit me. And I was like, I accept that challenge. I like this guy. I like free booze. Right? I love free alcohol. And the guy was offering me free alcohol. So I was like, I'm going to try this. I'm going to do what Anthony suggested. I guess I'll do it. I'll sign up for 1 year. I signed up for 1 year. So I did exactly what they told me to do. I surrendered. And they told me, you know, here you got to find a higher power. I didn't like that word God in the 12 steps. So I heard you can just put the word love in. You know, love as you understand love. You know, it's all about positive energy. And I love that we can define our own higher powers here. You know, there was this girl at our meeting a few weeks back. She used Mr. Rogers as her higher power. You know, because who doesn't love Mr. Rogers? You know, and he's positive. You know, he's welcoming. He's warm. He loves everybody. You know, you can have anybody you want. It's God as you understand God. And for me, what worked for me, and I got that advice at that meeting too, because I wasn't sure what I wanted to be my God, and I chose G-O-D, group of drunks. That was my God. And I listened to my God. I surrendered to my group of drunks. And I did everything that you told me to do. I got my sponsor, Pat, the lady that gave me the 20 questions and sold me that big book. She became my sponsor. I did the 12 steps. I made the amends. I learned the prayers. Even though I didn't like the prayers, I didn't like praying, I faked it until I felt it. That's what they told me to do. These prayers are in the book. They've been working since the 30s. Don't try to change it. Just do it exactly as it's outlined in the 12 steps. And I did exactly what they told me to do. And I took other pieces of advice. They told me stay away from slippery places and slippery faces. I loved going to those bars. But I was told my primary purpose is now not to just have fun, but to stay sober. It's to stay sober and help other alcoholics. And I didn't know if I kept going out to those karaoke bars if I could stay sober. So I bought a karaoke machine, and I started doing karaoke at home. And I'm known as the karaoke person in my group. If you have an AA sober party, I'm going to show up, and I'm going to bring my karaoke machine. So I stayed away from the bars. I stayed away from the liquor aisle in the store. I like to buy a handle of vodka. I still, 10 years sober, I don't walk down the liquor aisle. I don't go into liquor stores. I got no business being there. I don't go to bars. I still don't do that. And I heard, don't make any major changes in your first year. I really, really wanted to file for divorce. And I was told, at least do the step work. And look at your part. Look at your part. Because even if you don't keep on to this marriage, you may end up in another relationship. And you don't want to repeat the same mistakes. So in Al-Anon, I actually read that Discovering Choices book. It was the first time I had actually, in my family, I came from generations of women that, you know, here we don't drink no matter what. In my family, the motto was, you don't leave no matter what. It doesn't matter if you're getting abused. It doesn't matter, you know, if there are really bad things happening. You stay in that marriage no matter what. So reading that book, the Al-Anon book, there was a copy back there, Discovering Choices, that was a really big deal for me to realize that, and I was told if I waited a year and I still felt that way and I did the steps, I could file for divorce. And I ran everything past my sponsor. That was one thing I was told. I surrendered that my head, my thinking got me here, so I need to surrender my ideas to my sponsor. And she's been sober years more than me. She's going to have a better idea of how to handle things. And one of the best things that she does that I use now with my sponsees, every time I'd ask her for advice on stuff, she would just say to me, Heather, what's the best thing for your sobriety? And you can ask yourself that for any decision that you have to make. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help others. So if you've got a decision to make, a relationship, should I get into this relationship? Should I get out of this relationship? New job, should I take that job? Should I not take that job? Two of the most important things I think that contribute to our sobriety are having a job that's good for our sobriety and a relationship, a romantic relationship, a partner that's good for our sobriety. Those are the two places we spend the most time, right? Besides going to meetings, we live with a partner and we go to work. So those things got to be really good for our sobriety. And so I stayed in that relationship until I made it to that year. And that's what I did. I made it to that year. It was amazing. My first year came up, the birthday came up, and you know, a lot of people get nervous on their first birthday. And, oh, by the way, happy birthday, Teresa, wherever you are. Happy fourth birthday, congratulations. Happy birthday. My commitment actually at my home group, because I'm the party girl and I like to celebrate stuff, I'm the birthday celebrator. I think you can take those things with you into your sobriety, and you know, those things can still be an asset for you. So I'm actually the celebration girl at the studio group. So if you have a birthday, you want to take a cake with us anytime, come see me. We'll celebrate your birthday with you. I'll make sure you have a cake. I got to my 1 year. I surrendered and did everything that they told me to do. And I made it. I graduated, right? Because I only signed up for a year. And right before my birthday, I was like, what am I going to do? I'm done. I finished my year. That was all I was supposed to do. And but I had to take an inventory of where was my life? What was it like? And what is it like now? And when I did that comparison and I looked at it, I was healthier physically and emotionally. I was healthier and happier and more honest. The things that we get through the step work, more honest. I actually had hope in my life that even if my marriage ended, I was gonna be okay. I heard in an Al-Anon meeting, your marriage may not survive, but you will. And I had reconnected with my family. You know, I was actually celebrating birthdays. I made amends to my nephews. That year I flew out to Michigan. Those nephews who I used to walk right by, I said, hey, Aunt Heather's here to make amends with you guys. Aunt Heather, you're gonna have a different aunt now. You know, what do you guys wanna do today? They're like, you're gonna hang out with us? I was like, yeah, I'm a sober aunt now. What do you guys wanna do? And they said, well, we wanna play wiffle ball. Okay, got the wiffle ball, got the stuff. All of a sudden, they'd called all their friends over from the neighborhood. Aunt Heather's pitching tonight. And I went over there, and I pitched for like 3 hours to all the neighborhood kids. And I felt really good about it. I felt really good. I was like, wow, this is what it's like to be a sober aunt and to actually have a, you know, a relationship with these cool nephews that I'd been ignoring. And I actually started FaceTiming my family on their birthdays, people that I was ignoring. I said, you know, from now on, I'm never going to miss a birthday, and I haven't missed birthdays since I've been sober. And I started doing a lot of self-care. I was exercising. I started going to therapy. I was really sick. I was in twice a week therapy for like my first 5 years of sobriety. But that's what I needed. Now I'm all the way down to like once a month. It's amazing. It's a really good progress for me. And I had cleared up the wreckage of that past. The weddings I had crashed, I went and made amends to those people. I started thinking about my health too. I was like, man, now I'm in my 40s, you know, I was getting older and I'm looking so much younger. I looked like people thought I was in my 20s and I was in my 30s. I got the physical benefits when I stopped the drinking, and then I got all the emotional benefits when I did the steps. And like I said, I was feeling better. Oh, and I made amends to my parents. That was the biggest amends. I heard the amends that are the hardest, you will get the most benefit from. And those parents who had really screwed me over when I was a little girl, and who I think caused a lot of that anxiety and depression and kind of springboarded my alcoholism, I really did not want to face my parents. I really didn't want to do an amends with my dad. I said, this guy screwed me over so much worse than I screwed him in any way. And I listened and I surrendered to the process. And my sponsor said, no, you're going to do it. You're going to do it in person, and you're going to do it, and you're going to keep praying, and you're going to pray for the willingness, and you're going to do it. So I prayed and prayed, and it took me like a year and a half and like three times visiting my parents, and I finally made that amends with my dad. And, you know, and it says in the book, sometimes when we make an amends to someone, they make an amends back, and my dad did. And that was something. My dad is so stubborn. If it had not been for the 12 steps, me cracking that door open of making an amends and apologizing and my biggest harm to them, they were so worried about me and my drinking. They knew how much I was drinking, and they heard some of the stories, and they were really worried about me. Like I said, I wasn't returning my calls. They didn't know if I was dead or alive. I really worried them. So I got to make that amends, and my dad said, you know, there's some things from your childhood, and your mom said you've been bringing some stuff up lately, and I just thought you wouldn't remember that stuff. And I was like, are you kidding me? You know, and he said, so I've been carrying this around with me for 30 years, and I want to apologize to you and for the way that you were brought up. And there was one night that was really bad, ended up with blood and bruises. It was really bad. And he said, I'm really ashamed of that night, and it haunts me. And I just, thank you for this opportunity to acknowledge that that did happen. Your mom doesn't remember it. When actually your mom, when I brought it up to my mom goes, that's not true, that never happened to you. My mom was the one who cleaned up the blood, you know? But that's her trauma. She had a traumatic childhood too, and she was able to block that out. And she was probably high on pills when it happened. So my dad said, I acknowledge that that happened, and I'm sorry. And I wanted him so bad to apologize for like 10 other things, but I bit my tongue, and my sponsor was like, if he, you know, don't expect an apology back, don't expect an amends back, these people are not in a program, and whatever it is, just keep it short, keep the amends short. So I kept it short and just said, okay, yep, that one time it was horrible, you're right, and thank you. Thank you. And I'll tell you, I felt a new freedom and a new happiness and a new channel of love open in my heart when that amends was made. And that was the biggest, scariest amends that I had to make. I was trying to bargain. You know, sometimes if you have a therapist and a sponsor and like fellow travelers, you can get different opinions on things. And when she told me I had to do an in-person amends to my parents, I was like, I don't know if I like that idea. I think it's going to be harmful, you know, because it's only to the point that it doesn't cause harm. And I was like, my dad's a jerk, so he's going to cause harm when I make that amends. So I think I should do it on FaceTime. And so I got my therapist to sign off on that, but went back to the sponsor. And, you know, if your therapist and your sponsor disagree on advice, the sponsor, in my case, has always been right, and she was right. And I don't think my dad would have made that amends if I had not done that one in person. So surrendering to the process, trusting the process, I surrendered to the advice from the group of drunks. And it worked. So I made it that 1 year. I had done all those amends. I had cleared the wreckage. I felt better. I looked better. And I decided, you know what, it's worth it to stay. It is worth it to stay. And it's still to this day, 10 and a half years later, it is still worth it to this day. Best decision I've ever made is to stick around. and to stay sober and continue with the primary purpose that you guys taught me. My primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. My primary purpose was not to stay married. It was not to get rich. You know, it was not to be famous. So in the second year, I did the most difficult thing I've ever had to do in sobriety. I did file for divorce my second year. And he actually did, after I got sober, he got sober for a little bit too. And he actually decided, and it's really sad when you watch another person. You know, he had gotten sober, he was doing step work. The sponsor I picked out, Paul, that at that first meeting, he actually did use him as a sponsor. And he did some step work, you know. Sometimes Al-Anons can push him in the right direction. But he got to step 8 in the harm step. And, you know, a lot of people go out 4 and 5 and 8 and 9 is where a lot of people go out. And that's where he decided he couldn't do it anymore. He could not look at the harm he had done and the wreckage he had done. And he didn't want to make amends. So he just said, you know what, I think I'm just going to just not drink anymore. And, you know, I think I got this. Every time I've ever heard an alcoholic, because I've heard sponsees say this too, I've got this. The minute you say, I've got this, it's got you. The disease has got you. That's that surrender and the God's will and our will. That's when they take their will back. And so he exited the program and I exited the marriage. He did relapse. I saw it coming. When you go all the way back to step one, I heard you work the steps in reverse. As you start to go out, he quit going to the meetings. He quit calling his sponsor. You know, and he went all the way back to step one. I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I don't know if it's a problem. All the way back to step one. And so I prayed. I prayed to my higher power, show me a sign. I think, you know, again, I came from a family where you don't file for divorce. You don't leave no matter what. And he went back that one night he went out and he cheated again. And he drank again. And I thought, you know what, I can't do this. And, you know, I talked to my sponsor about it, and what was her advice? What's the best thing for your sobriety? The guy's drinking again. Do you think you can stay sober if you stay married to this guy who's cheating and still lying to you and still drinking? So I had to end the marriage. I did. 2 days before Valentine's Day, he was on a business trip, and I knew, and this time I listened. I have a higher power. I've heard, I had a gut feeling, and I heard that gut feeling you get is your higher power talking to you. And for the first time, I surrendered to that message, and I paid attention, and I called him up and said, hey, I have a feeling something happened on that business trip. And he was like, you're right, let me come talk to you. I have a feeling you're going to file for divorce. And he was right. 2 days later on Valentine's Day, I sent him divorce papers. My higher power has a sense of humor. I surrendered. I surrendered. I had said prayers, said, you know, God, is it your will? Because I think it is your will at this point to end the marriage, and I filed for divorce. And that is the other best decision I've ever made for my sobriety. Because I don't think if I would have stayed in the alcoholic marriage, I could have stayed sober. Since then, the last 8 years of my sobriety, it's continuing to do everything I learned. I heard at a meeting somebody said, you know, we really learn in our first year everything we need to know. It's just a matter of whether we do it or not. You know, I like that thing that we say. I heard the most important thing we hear at a meeting is the thing that we do at the end when we hold hands. It works if you work it. And if you're standing next to me, you'll hear me say, and it won't if you don't. So I continue to work the program. I continued, the topic was surrender. I have continued for the last 10 years of my sobriety, surrender. I wake up every morning, I've surrendered to the fact I haven't relapsed yet. Y-E-T, you're eligible too. I accept the fact that I am eligible for relapse. And I hear enough stories of relapse. And I went up and I would like interview people my first year. Why did you relapse? Why do you think that you relapsed? If they didn't mention it in their story, 99% of those people said, I quit going to meetings. I quit going to meetings. So I have surrendered to the advice of everybody saying, if you don't want to relapse, keep going to the meetings. Keep doing the meetings. But some people go to the meetings and they're still a little cuckoo, right? those are the people that aren't doing the step work still. So, you know, I've met some really crazy old timers, and sometimes you hear some really crazy shares. And so I try to do both things. I still go to the meetings. I've surrendered to the fact that it's better for me to still go to the meetings and to still do the step work and to continue to do, like I said, everything I learned in that first year. I have like 4 commitments at my home group. I still go to 3 to 5 meetings a week. I still call my sponsor every Monday. I've also surrendered to sponsorship. I don't like sponsoring. I don't like it. I keep a little tally in my phone. I probably shouldn't, but I do because it's depressing. I've sponsored 13 different girls over the last 10 years. I started sponsoring around 2 years, so like the last 8 years. And only 2 of them have stayed sober. And those are girls that left and got different sponsors. And, but my sponsor has told me, you know, you've still got 100% success rate. You haven't drank over a single one of them. So I've got 100% success rate with sponsorship. And if you haven't drank over your sponsees yet, you do too. So I like that. I try to keep that positive spin and surrender to the fact that it's okay. You know, it's okay. All I have to do is I have to stay sober. And when I sponsor people, I say, hey, let's go to, you know, oh, I'm going to this new meeting. I go to those new meetings. You know, I start to reread the book. You know, it does help me. And that is my primary purpose, right? To stay sober and to help others. And recently, you know, I got really tired. I had gotten this one girl through as many steps as I'd ever gotten somebody through. And I was like, finally, I think I'm going to get someone through all the 12 steps. And she again got to step 9, and she didn't want to do the amends. She had someone she couldn't do an amends to, and she went out. Her dad died. You know, I heard, you know, you have to be prepared. The darkness is going to come. People are going to die. You know, marriages are going to end. Car crashes are going to happen. Tragedy is going to happen. If we're not prepared, we're going to drink. And she did just like my ex-husband. She had slowed down on the meetings. She'd given up her commitments. And her dad died. And she went out. And so I told my sponsor, I'm kind of burned out on sponsorship, honestly. You know, and she said, you know, you do so many other commitments. You know, some of your character defects can actually become assets. I'm a control freak. I'm very organized and hyper-organized. So I make a really good secretary. You know, I take the business meetings at the business minutes at the business meetings. I'm still the party girl, so I celebrate the birthdays. I make sure there's cake. I invite the people back from the phone list. But I lost my train of thought. Sponsorship. Okay. So I surrendered. I surrendered to a higher power. You know, it says, you know, turn our life and our will over to a higher power. And for me, again, it's still the group of drunks. And my sponsor said, why don't you just pray on it? And whenever I'm looking for answers, I pray on things. And I said, you know, I don't want to sponsor anymore, but there's this one girl. And her name is Hillary. And she left the program 5 years ago. 5 years ago. Somebody became president, and she couldn't handle that president. She went out and drank. That was her excuse, right? No good reason to drink, but we'll find excuses. And that was her excuse. So I actually messaged her when we got a new president after he was done. After 4 years, I was like, hey, he's no longer president. You can come back. And she's like, I can't. I can't quit drinking. You know, she was so far down the rabbit hole at that point. You know, and I heard, you know, drinking with alcoholism is a one-way elevator down. You know, we don't have to get off on the bottom floor. You don't have to end up in jail or an institution. You don't have to die. And she had gotten worse, just like it says. And she was up to a couple bottles a day, and her family life was in trouble. And I said to my sponsor, I've got one person, and if that person comes back, I thought she'd never come back. But I prayed about it and said, God, you know, because we're supposed to ask him in our morning meditation what we can do for the person still suffering. And I said, I know she's suffering, and if there's any way that she comes back to the program, I will sponsor again, and I will sponsor this woman. 2 months after I did that, on my natal birthday, October 1st, I got a text message from Hillary. She'd been out for 5 years. And she said, oh my God, my family just had an intervention with me. I thought it was a birthday party. I showed up for my aunt's birthday, and it was an effing intervention. And Heather, I'm going to rehab. And I was like, this is the best birthday ever. My sponsee, they're like our babies, you know? We want them to stay sober. And I had done so much work with her in the couple years she was in the program before. So, you know, if you just talk to your higher power about who can I help, where can I help? And in this case, again, she was out for 5 years. I never would have thought that saying that prayer and surrendering and saying, you know what, I will help if this person comes back. And she came back and she just took a chip for 6 months. She's got 6 months, and oh, it makes me so proud. I'm like a proud, such a proud sponsor about that. So again, just all that's from is surrendering and putting it up to the higher power and continuing to do what I was told to do here. And you know, 10 years later, I still feel healthier and happier than I ever did when I was out drinking. And it's through continuing to surrender to my group of drunks who I love so much. And I'll end with this. You know, I heard, you know, when it comes to the meetings, you know, and people talk about, I heard, don't leave AA for the life that AA gave you. You know, I heard a lot of people, I can't go to the meetings. I got to do this with my kids. I got to, you know, one guy left. Oh, I can't come to the meeting anymore Tuesday night. I got tennis practice, you know, and he quit going to the meetings, you know, and we get to do, again, the hourglass, it gets fuller. I've got a lot more friends now. I've got a lot more activities. I'm traveling all over the place. I'm going to Hawaii next week. I wanted to go to Hawaii one time in sobriety. I've gone like 6 times, you know. I have a really big, full life, but when I go to Hawaii, I zoom into the meeting, because my sobriety is the most important thing for me. And so I haven't given up, and I've surrendered on still coming to the meetings and still doing the step work. I do a 10th step if I have to talk to my sponsor about something that's bothering me. I continue to do the prayers and the meditation, and I continue to do the service that I've been told. If I keep doing it, I can stay sober, and that's how I've stayed sober for the last 10 and a half years. And this program does work if you work it, and again, it won't if you don't. So keep surrendering and keep working it, and yeah, you'll get a lot more serenity and sobriety too. Thanks.